This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
You're listening to Surreal Talk, a look inside the world of cults, conspiracies, and the paranormal.
Something's not right, man. Something's not right. Something's bullshit here, and I don't believe it.
Honestly, this crazy shit could be completely possible.
Disclaimer, we reserve the right to be wrong, ladies and gentlemen. You think you know the whole story? Think again.
Now your hosts, Eric and Everett.
Welcome to Surreal Talk, a look inside the worlds of cults, conspiracies, and the paranormal, a lineupmedia.fm production, and we are back.
Sadly, a proper intro.
What do you mean?
I've always hated how you do that. We are back, you know, that whole thing?
Yeah.
But it feels weird without it.
That's like my thing, man.
I know, it feels weird.
Like, everybody's got their thing, like, things that make you go, like Arsenio, you know?
No? That was Arsenio?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Anyway, what are we talking about this week?
Well, we should talk about who we have with us. We have a special guest today. Phil Kaler is his name. And Phil, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself while we're having you on today to talk about hell.
You've not been to hell, right?
Have you been there?
No.
Never been, okay.
He's been to
Wood River. Not recently.
It's close.
But I think first and foremost, I'm an Alabama fan, so we just got another championship ring on our fingers.
There you go.
I say we because I'm a fan, so we're part of the team.
Nice.
But probably the reason you guys have me here, in college, I studied religion. I did all the religions, but kind of focused on the books of Abraham, I guess you could say, you know, Christianity, Judaism, Islam. And, I've liked to study it a lot. So
he has actual knowledge.
Yeah, as opposed to our, you know,
yeah,
whatever you would call our knowledge, yeah, not actual.
Nothing. Anyway, so what I wanted to talk about first
is... I had another question.
Oh, okay.
You studied religion in college. Would you consider yourself a religious man or a practicing religious person? Ooh, you go to church every Sunday? Or you don't have to answer if you don't want to. I was just curious.
I don't because, I find a little bit of issue with some of the churches. I like to read the Bible from front to back. You know, I started... First one and end when I end the chapter, at least, or in the book. And a lot of times you get to a church and they will read one verse and then talk for an hour. So, I like to get down to the deep study and get the meat and potatoes and not just milk.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. All religion aside, in its simplest form, do you believe in a higher power?
Well, absolutely.
Okay, right. So that's fair. So in whatever form that may take, whether it be... Something. I mean,
well, it's a higher power. It's not named. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Quit throwing stuff at me, Eric.
Okay. I think the biggest difference is, you know, studying it for yourself and really getting into the actual Bible, or, you know, kind of carrying on traditions, you know, that you get from mom and dad and, you know, Preacher John and stuff. So, I think there's a big difference there.
Sure.
I'm the same way. I actually love reading the Bible myself. I was telling Eric earlier today, the Christian radio station in town still has a place on my speed dial in my car because every now and then I like stopping and listening to those sermons about how they dissect some of the Bible stuff. It's different how you said, I was thinking a minute ago, how you said you don't go to church because you like to basically read into the source materials yourself and come up with your own, you know, opinions on it. I'm sort of the same way, but I don't really have the time recently to dive back into the Bible, but I love to hear the discussion on the radio about it. I don't know. I find it interesting. Even though I myself am not a religious person, I don't believe in God per se, but I do – it fascinates me. Religion fascinates me. Always has.
Oh, it's a tantalizing thought. It really is. I mean, think that, you know, like
this is,
there's
what
a
you
better
see
place.
Isn't what you get.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so much more. You know, it's that something's missing. I mean, it does. It strikes every human at one point or another in their life. You know what I mean? So belief in a higher power, or in this case, a hell. And if you believe in some sort of higher, a better place, does there have to be a worse place? Because, you know, that's what a lot of people say. You know, if you believe in heaven, you must believe in hell. I mean,
yeah,
if you
does
just
hell not have, or heaven not have value?
Well, right. Is hell in the general sense of the term, a religious construct? Is that something religion's made up?
Yes, I mean, would say so.
You know what
religion...
I mean? Because when you're thinking about it in its simplest form as just a higher power, no one really ever talks about what he does, you know what I mean? Or whatever. So, you know, I associate the normal version of hell with religions.
Sure, sure.
What would you say, Phil? You think that would be a fair assumption?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. But, you know, so much of what is quote unquote Christianity or religion is, you know, oral tradition. You know, I know it sounds judgmental and, you know, it probably is a little bit, but there's, you know, we all know those people that never miss a Sunday. They're sitting at the same pew every Sunday, but they don't even know what the books of the Bible are, let alone what's inside of them. But they can tell you all about God, but that also comes from, again, passed down traditions.
That's very true. And it goes more into the discussion, too. In my research, the Bible doesn't actually describe hell as how most people think of it, right? There's no talk of the raining sulfur or anything like that in the Bible, is there?
No. No. I mean, like, you know, fire and brimstone and gnashing of teeth, those things are all there. But again, when you're picking one sentence out of the middle of a book, you know, you're starting to form your own opinion. And I think the Bible is probably the only book where we say, I'm just going to open it up and read one sentence and then I know what this book's about.
Yeah, whatever, context aside, here's your lesson.
That's an issue I've always had with the Bible, or actually religion in general, is how they can pick and choose which parts to follow, you know, because there's some pretty
bad... And assigned context.
Exactly. There's an assigned context.
That's
what I say, context. That's very much more important than picking and choosing. But there's parts in there where people will just tell you, oh, it's outdated, you know, like, you know, stuff. There's all kinds of things. I mean, I know there's rape and murder and child marriage, you know, adults marrying children, and, you know, some of that shit's okay. But people will tell you, oh, that's just because it's outdated, you know, don't worry about that. Read into what it means. And it's like, thinking in my head, you're married an 8-year-old, you know, or his 12-year-old cousin or whatever. Whatever the story may be, which I'm sure there's a few in there, am I right?
Yeah, and, you know, and also you have to realize that, you know, Greek and Hebrew have 9 to 10,000 words they use, and they have never changed. I mean, the Greek and Hebrew that were used, you know, 2,000 years ago are the same. And English changes, you know, sometimes in a decade. I mean, for example, the word gay. I mean, look how much that's changed over the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, right, sure.
In my research, too, a lot of the transliteration that takes place, the translating of taking one letter and just pushing it into a new language because it looks similar, that happens a lot with whenever they were doing the old translations. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
Actually, the 1611 King James, when they translated from Greek and Hebrew straight to English, they put a disclaimer out that said, this is the best that we can do, but you really need to go look into it yourself.
Yeah, in the King James Bible, we have it written down here from our research, that the word hell is actually rendered from the word Sheol 31 times and Hades 10 times. So they're taking two different original words and putting them into one singular concept. So that's kind of weird, too.
Absolutely. There's 7 different words that are translated into death.
Hit me with a few of them. I'm curious. If you wouldn't mind, yeah, hit me with a few of them.
That's insane. Seven?
Yeah, I don't...
I got you.
I mean, like, you know, there's a difference between a lying in wait murder, a crime of passion, negligent homicide, killing in war, killing an animal, you know, and they're all just turned into, you know, all translated into one word, kill.
Let me ask you this. And what does hell mean to you? So, like, when someone brings up the word hell, do you, in your mind, automatically still go to the fiery place, you know, the pitchfork devil, you know, burning and torment, suffer and pain? Do you automatically still take it there, like the lessons we were taught as kids when someone mentions hell? What does hell mean to you?
You know, I think my understanding and my thought of hell is different, and I think when someone brings it up to me, I kind of go with what they're thinking. And you know, you can kind of you know what people were taught and passed down. I mean, you know, most of what we get from is, you know, off TV or oral traditions. So what does it mean to me? You know, it's it's the grave. It's the great beyond. But is that now, or is that still yet to come? You know, is there a ruler of hell right now that, you know, down there with souls that have already been judged? The Bible doesn't say so, but, you know, I know that's the common theory, and it's shared.
Sure.
Yeah, to me, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about hell, but if somebody was to say go to hell, for instance, in my literal interpretation, I don't think that means they're saying go down to the place of fire and brimstone and eternal pain. I think
no, for sure.
They're just saying, I hope you suffer.
But
so hell to me is suffering in any form at its basis. Thing. It's in a religious sense, I would think it would be. We watched several videos on this today, and the one that really stuck with me was the absence of God. So anything without God in an afterlife in a religious sense would be hell.
Fair.
I don't know. I think that stuck to me the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be fair enough. I think it's more of God being absent of you.
Ooh.
Mm, I didn't ever think about it like that.
Yeah, that's kind of deep. I'm going to
have to... Well, what's Ben Affleck saying, Dogma? He feels the absence of the divine presence. Like, he misses it. It pains him. It hurts him. And that's just kind of like right along with what you guys are saying right here. You know what I mean? He can tell that what was there isn't there now.
Right. And to sit there and preach about an all-loving God that, I mean, look at John 3:16. You know, he gave his life for us to have everlasting life. I mean, someone to go through, come in the flesh and have the ridicule and to be crucified. I mean, someone to love you that much. He's not going to spend all of eternity knowing that he has his children there being tortured.
Right, that's very contradictory, right? For him to be an all-loving, all-knowing, generous, gracious, merciful God, and you can be forgiven in so many ways. And if that's the case, and he can always find it in his proverbial heart to forgive you, then why is there even a hell if he can just, you know, say, hey, you know, you did shit wrong. Think about it like this, and then that's it. Game over. Come on in the club, bro.
It the free will, the choice of choose God or not choose God at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, you both are fathers, right?
Right.
Yes.
A whole lot for you to, you know, put one of your kids away, you know, from you.
Yeah, exactly. And if he's supposed to be the all father, you know, that we're all his children, God's children.
Think about it like this, too. To put one of your kids away, true. But and then think about if you force them to be on your side. You know what I mean? Do you want your kid to love you for merit, or do you want your kid to love you because you said you have no other choice but to love me? And if you don't, this is your.
That's fair. Like, say perhaps you die, and then, like, you know, you're at the gates, and he's like, you know, I know you didn't believe in me before, or whatever. You know, say as an atheist, I know you didn't believe in me before, but here's proof. See it back there? See, doesn't that look beautiful? Now, do you still not want to believe in me? And would he give you the choice to just blink out of existence or join the club?
So this goes
an interesting thought, you know what I mean?
The thought of purgatory, too, and the use of purgatory. We watched a real nice video on this today from a priest. He was talking about it. So say God does pluck you out of hell. You're ready to come up to heaven. He says you've did your time or however that works. And you accept that, you know, God in your heart, but you're not right with the fact of your mortal sin. So you are a rapist or a thief, and you just can't let that go. Even though you're not out of hell anymore, you got to go to a place where you believe it in your heart that, A, you're no longer this, and you're okay with what you did before, and that you are right with God, so to speak. So does that make sense to you about purgatory?
Right. What I took from it was that it was like the final place of purification after serving your sentence in hell. And so, like, yeah, you can be ready to accept God in your heart and everything, but if you're not ready for heaven and you can't get into heaven— you know, having these weights on your chest so much, how people think like a ghost is still here to solve problems that they had in their life. Purgatory is a place for you to get right with yourself, from my understanding, where it would be like, I just can't let go of the fact I'm guilty of what I have done. Yeah, I've served my time and I've done my sentence, but it still feels bad. Well, that's a place to purify you to get ready to go in and enjoy enjoy heaven for all it is. Like the final process. You know what I mean?
My only problem with that is I can't separate the fact that I've always heard that hell was an eternal sentence.
Fair, yeah. But you know what? We've heard that where, though? You heard that where? Where did you hear
right,
that?
Right, I didn't read it.
No, people have just said that, you know, and like he was just saying oral traditions, the people just saying that, where did that even come from? You know, like you just said, you have no idea, but you've always heard that it was an eternal sentence. But come to find out today, we don't know, you know, or as far as the religion goes, we don't know that it's an eternal sentence.
Phil, what's your thoughts on purgatory, at least classically from your training?
Well, I mean, I think we all have a decent idea of where it came from, right? I mean, it got popular with Dante.
Right.
He wrote about it because, you know, I guess he thought that he was the judge, you know, and he thought that this guy and that guy and this woman, you know, this is what they deserved for all the things that they did. Purgatory, it really, to me, it sounds like you can earn your way to salvation. And it's not that you believe in Christ or that, you know, that he was the sacrifice for one and all sins, that you can basically just earn your way in. You go and you pay your, you know, pittance and you roll a rock up the hill or, you know, whatever the sentence was that you get. You know, you don't need Christ, and it has nothing to do with what he did for you. It's what you are doing and earning your way in.
That's a very good way to look at it.
So heaven, in regards to, it's not about your relationship with God. It's more or less how, I don't know, how right you are on the inside. Like if you're a moral good person and moral and good with yourself, that's all it takes? Or not in relation? Well, go ahead, sorry.
I mean, if you believe in an all-knowing God that's always existed and created you and created all of this and he knows your every thought, you know, I think every individual has a different degree of judgment. You know, you wouldn't judge a six-year-old the same way you would judge an 18-year-old. And God
Fair
knows
point.
Your thought.
Yeah, they know not what they do, that type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you see people that have mental disabilities or they just don't have their eyes open to the world. And, you know, you can't hold them accountable the same that you would hold somebody that, you know, really digs into it and tries to figure out what it's about.
Fair enough. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the whole innocence of a child versus, you know, the innocence of a handicapped person or someone who's mentally, you know, deficient.
Right. So therein lies the problem. In the Bible, doesn't it say that as babies? Well, I shouldn't say doesn't it say. You're probably gonna be able to tell me where and when. But like, does it say that you're born into original sin now? Because like, or Jesus was the perfect sacrifice in order for us to be able to go to heaven, right? Or am I wrong?
That's something to do with baptism,
too. Yeah, he became our Passover lambs, what Paul said.
Okay, but so before they sacrificed him, they were sacrificing animals, right? In like Old Testament, wasn't that what he was to replace, the same sort of sacrifice?
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the things that was nailed up on the cross with him were the blood ordinances, you know, and a lot of people, they really don't know the difference between a law, an ordinance, and a statute. They're all very different things, you know. We have them today.
Yeah, sure.
That's another thing I came up with was the law of the Lord versus the law of Moses is basically what you're talking about. Ordinance law versus the law that comes straight from God's mouth, like the Ten Commandments.
Right. Yeah. And you know, Christ said in all the different, you know, all the Gospels that, you know, I will not change one jot or tittle of the law. You know, he came to fulfill the law. He is the walking embodiment of it. So, you know, we know what a jot or a tittle is. I mean, you know, a little tilde above an N in Spanish. I mean, that mm-hmm. makes the, you know, so he's not even changing it that much. So the law has never been done away with.
So how do you feel about that, too, like in relation to going to hell? The breaking the Ten Commandments versus just breaking the simple laws of man. And people assign, you know, tell you from, oh, fuck, I'm really butchering this question. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, anytime you break one of the Ten Commandments, it's a hellable sin, right?
Hell-worthy trespass?
Something like that, yeah.
Well, the Bible says there's only one unforgivable sin, you know, and that's the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. That's probably that's a topic all on its own. But, you know, sins are forgivable. There are some that are still, you know, in the Bible deemed punishment by death. And that is rape and premeditated murder.
But death is one thing, and eternal damnation is another. So,
absolutely.
Explain to me the difference. I guess the reasoning you think that they would have had. I know I'm asking you to put yourself in the mind of the people who wrote the Bible or created these rules, or maybe it was God.
Kind of a tall order, Everett.
But
you're going to have to repeat that because you froze up on me.
Sure. Sorry about that. So can you explain to me the difference? Let me see how I can word this here. I've lost my question there. Where was I going with that, Eric? You follow me, right?
No. God damn. I don't follow you at all.
Oh, you said the only unforgivable sin was?
Rape, murder.
No.
Blasphemy of the Holy Spirit.
Blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. How is that any worse than, in their minds, how can they make that worse than murder or rape? How is that different to God?
Well, you have to go to like Mark 13, Luke 21, or Matthew 24, and it's a very specific time. You know, we're talking very end days when God's election is standing up against, you know, the Antichrist. And, you know, anti in Greek means instead of Christ. They were talking about, you know, Satan coming in disguised as, you know, the Savior. You know, his election will be speaking out about, you know, against those people. And, you know, he tells us when you're thrown into, you know, trial and into jails, you know, for speaking out against that, that the Holy Spirit will speak through you. And to deny that, that's blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. I mean, it's not saying God damn or whatever, because right. God's not his name.
So it's being presented with more or less the not the evidence of God, but the presence of God and denying it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
that's interesting. That kind of makes sense. If I was writing the rules and I said, if I give you here I am and you still deny me, then you're definitely not coming here. But in your mortal existence, if you killed someone and then were completely repentant, like honestly in your soul repentant, come on in. I could see where that'd be a difference. It's a principle type of thing, but it's kind of a dick move. But I can get the principle of it.
Yeah, and I think that I might have, you know, you might have misunderstood me there. Blasphemy of the Holy Spirit isn't denying God or telling somebody that God doesn't exist. It's a very specific action at a very specific time. So
it's like I don't mean denying that he exists. I mean, it's like if Eric was here and says, I am with you and I am your friend and I am everything for you or something along that lines, just announcing this his presence and filling you, and you still go, no, I'm not with you. And is that it? Like, not denying the existence, just denying God, you.
Well, and when he gives you the thing to say, and you refuse to say it, that's really what it comes down to. Again, you have to read the chapter. It's a very specific time in history, or, you know, I guess the future.
You better choose my team type of thing?
No, it's when he is, it's when, you know, it's a very specific time in history. I mean, we're talking about after, you know, Satan comes back to earth and proclaims himself to be God. And, you know, he's not going to come in red long underwear with the pitchfork
and
horns. He's going to come probably looking like all the pictures of Jesus that we see today. So
just a false God.
The false god. Paul calls him a taxon, a cheap imitation. It's actually pretty funny when he says it like that. But so basically, you know, the Bible says that there'll be people speaking against this and that they're going to be, you know, brought in front of, you know, tribunes and judges. And at that point, the Holy Spirit will give you what to say. That it says even the gainsayers, you know, even those that hate you will be convinced that the voice speaking through you is God's. So kind of like speaking in tongues in Joel or in Acts. You know, it said the people heard it even in their very own dialect. So the Spanish people heard it in Spanish and the Chinese people heard it in Chinese. So again, it's probably a tall one.
No, I think I get you. You're saying when it's at the end of the day, it's past Armageddon, and here's Satan and here's God, and it's obvious that God he's told you what to say, and you're just not believing that this is the real God, more or less.
Oh, it's your refusal to be his mouthpiece.
Ah, okay, I get you there.
Would that be out of spite, or would that be
any
like
reason? I would guess.
Well, what about out of fear of Satan?
So are you saying why would a person blaspheme? Is what you're asking, Eric?
Yeah. Like, would God understand if you were just in fear of Satan, you know?
I think he would show you that you didn't have to be afraid. I don't know.
Well, I think if you're in that position, at that time, he can count on you. I'll just say that. I don't think that everybody's going to be in that position.
Fair enough. Fair enough. That makes sense. See, I had another good question here. Is there differences in hell, like the definition of hell, and how you get into it based on the different sects of Christianity? Like, is it different for Catholicism versus, say, I don't know, the Protestants?
I think at the end of the day, I mean, if you exclude purgatory, I think they all kind of teach it the same way.
Fair enough. So you're not going to go to a Pentecostal church and have a little set of stricter rules based on, you know, or you go to hell, that type of thing? Like, don't drink soda on Sunday versus it's fine. I know that's not a thing they do, but I'm just saying an example.
Right.
There's no extra rules based on a more strict sect of Christianity that you know of.
No, I don't really think so. I mean, I think it's a pretty general. It's pretty much the same.
Fair enough. I really was wondering about that one.
So we've all been wondering when we're going to get to the big question.
What's the big question?
What about a soul, man? It's not your body when you die. It would initially just be your soul in hell. Am I right or am I wrong there? Right. If you go to hell, you don't take your body with you and your flesh, do you? It's your soul.
Well, it's the same question can be asked about heaven, too. Do you go as your soul or do you go as a physical body, like as a reincarnated body of perfection?
According to religion, what would be the answer there, Phil?
I think Paul says it best. He says you doff the corrupt and don the incorruptible. He talks about a soul with inside a spiritual body. We're talking, and we're created in God's image, right? So Christ also said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So, you know, I'm sure that we can say we look like the flesh, but we're not out of the flesh. You know, and I've talked about with other people about, well, we won't be in flesh bodies, but we'll be in spiritual bodies. And, you know, like Everett just said, what, like reincarnation, you know, and if you look at that word by definition, re, you know, to do something again, incarnation, to be in the flesh. And, you know, when I say moving from a flesh body to a spiritual body, that means you're putting the flesh down. Real quick, in Genesis chapter 6, God said he even repented of himself for putting us into flesh bodies because, you know, flesh is very weak.
Great answer. So here's something. According to a Harris poll released in December of 2013, 64% of Americans believe in the survival of the soul after death. And a majority believe in both heaven and hell. So, I mean, that's 64%. They may not be religious, but they believe that your soul will survive after your death. You know what I mean? A soul's a funny thing. Like, I heard a story one time. A lady, you know, this was one of those shows that you watch. And I guess it could have been made up, but it was very interesting. Where they die and they come back and they tell you what they experienced in their 5-8 minutes they were out or whatever. And this lady said that it was nothing like everyone thinks, like with the big bright light.
She had a near-death experience.
Exactly, a near-death experience. And what she felt was just like a warm, fuzzy ball of energy, just like bright, shining energy. She was just like zooming around, and she could. There was no communication. Like, they weren't talking. It wasn't about that. It was, but she could feel her loved one zooming with her. Like, it was the weirdest way. Just a bright, shiny, fuzzy ball of warm energy, and it was like the greatest feeling that she'd ever experienced. And that was what she had described as what, you know, like maybe that was her soul. She was trying to rationalize it, you know what I mean? And she was like, I'm trying to think of how that was, but I just can't really describe it. I was a fuzzy ball of energy.
That makes a good sense too, because I've always thought, if there is an afterlife, I don't think we can have a concept of what that existence is. It's not a place of time and space, in my opinion, if it exists. It's a place of etherealness. It's not an existence how we even possibly understand it, not as a mist or as an energy. I don't think we have the capacity to understand what it really is to be in another way of existence like that.
I agree.
I mean, God doesn't, if you know, the classic idea of God as I understand it, he's not a guy walking around in a white robe with a big white beard. He's not a guy at all. I mean, he's more of a force.
Not anything, yeah.
He doesn't speak English. He doesn't convey words.
It's beyond that. It's like, you're absolutely right. In our human capacity, we could probably never understand truly what heaven, hell, conversation with God would be. You know,
yeah. Until you get to that level of existence, I don't think you can understand what sin is at that point. You know, until you truly realize, again, in a religious sense, and I'm not a religious man, but trying to rationalize my understanding of it, you can't know what you did to another thing that exists and whenever you don't know the whole picture of what that thing is. I don't know. That's just my thought.
Very good point, though. Yeah. I don't know, man. The soul's a tricky thing. What do you think? What's your take on souls? Do you think that's a thing? Like, you believe in the higher power? Is that how we unite with the higher power or reach the higher power would be through our soul?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that God, you know, put in you. I mean, we know the difference. You know, we see the difference in every one of us. And that's not just neurons firing differently. That's their soul. And I don't think that you even need to ever have stepped inside a church or a synagogue or whatever, a mosque, to know the difference between right and wrong. You feel it. You know the difference.
Totally agree. I totally agree. And that's the same reason why I like listening to those religious, you know, things on the radios, because to me it's not about God so much as morality and how to be.
Speaks to your soul?
Well, maybe to my soul, whatever you want to call it. It speaks to the part of me that wants to do right by others. You know what I mean? How I should act in relation to others, because that's really important, is your interactions and how, in my opinion anyway. That's what I take from that is just the thought of how to be proper. How to treat somebody else and just in a way I'd like to be treated. And they talk about that and discuss it. So
fair.
That's what I get from it.
You know, and I think Ecclesiastes chapter 12 says it best when, you know, God says, he uses, you know, Hebraisms, like when the clay pot breaks and the silver cords released, the soul returns to the Father who gave it. So that means that all of them, it doesn't say, hey, you went there, or in Ezekiel when he says, all souls are mine. You know, I hear people all the time saying, well, you can sell your soul to the devil. It's not yours to sell. You know, it belongs to God. He gave it to you.
That makes sense.
Right. Yeah, so there would be nothing you could do to offer your soul to the devil then, huh? Yeah, because it's not
it's
yours.
Like, you don't have the title of the car, so you can't sell it.
Right. It's a loaner. It's a mortgaging. You're financing the.
Let's swerve the conversation here and take it back to the original origin of hell. If you take it from an outside religious standpoint, from the men who wrote, and if you completely say religion is phony, that's what you got to think about in this line of thought. Why they would have written the story of hell, the need for a hell as a society, and it really comes down to the fact of we need a way to keep people in line.
Control.
They don't believe in the power of what, of my consequence as a lawmaker. So I have to threaten you with your existence after the fact of what you're dead. I think that's where the need for hell comes at a very visceral level.
If that's the case, and it was created as some construct to keep people in line, fucking works. I mean, it's a legit strategy.
What do you think, Phil? I don't know what the original version of hell was, the original religion. I'm sure every religion since the first one probably had a negative afterlife. Can you give us your insight on that?
Well, you have to, you know, realize that, you know, Egyptian religion, it's Greek, Roman religions. I mean, these things were around thousands of years before Christianity.
Right.
And, you know, when Paul, I forget the exact word, Tartus or whatever he uses. I mean, he's speaking to Greek. You know, and if you were trying to explain something to, you know, another, you're going to speak at the language they understand. You're going to use the imagery they understand. That's why he uses Hades. I mean, you know, Aristotle, Homer, Plato. I mean, they talked about these, the graves, you know, the Romans and Greeks, you know, they talked about, again,
the pits,
you know,
and, yeah.
Pits. I mean, so they all had their own version of things. But, you know, Christianity, you know, if you look into what the Bible says, specifically, they, you know, he talks about a lake of fire. But in Revelation, he talks about hell and death both being tossed into the lake of fire. So, I mean, if you want your mind blown, how does hell get tossed into the lake of fire?
Yeah. Fourth wall break. So I have something wrote down that's like damn near exactly what you just said, Phil. I wrote down, it's worth mentioning that the imagery in the book of the Revelation is notably similar to ancient Egyptian religion, where the judgment of souls in the court hall of the god Osiris and the idea of the dam being cast into a lake of fire. This was well before the apocalypse or Peter or the Bible for that matter, dating upwards of thousands of years BC. The Greek idea of Tartarus also appears in the Christian Bible in 2 Peter 2:4. That's what you said.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think you also have to realize that, you know, in my view, what I've read, that Satan is not locked into this hell as of now. I mean, Revelation says, you know, the hour, or the, you know, for 1.5 hours, heaven is silent when Satan has and his angels are kicked out of heaven by Michael the archangel. So I mean, he's there right now, and he's enchained, and so.
Wait, are you telling me Satan's in heaven?
Sounds like he's in heaven's jail.
In chains, you can read it right there in Revelation.
No, I believe you. It's just it's just like that's a common misconception. I wasn't aware of that. That's insane. You know, it's like you just said, you thought that it was an eternal sentence, you know, eternal damnation. You know, you learn something every day. I wonder where that came. Most everyone assumes.
Let me ask us, if Satan or the devil, Satan, whatever you want to call him, is in heaven and he's in chains, then how is he able to affect people on earth and to influence people? I mean, logically. I know you don't have these answers. You're not a priest or anything like that. It's just a little chink in the story here.
The book of Job, you read the first 30-something chapters, it's a bunch of nonsense. It's man telling Job what he did wrong. And, you know, that final quote-unquote man, you know, is, again, telling Job what he did wrong, and it was Satan. If you read the beginning of Job, who's having the conversation? It's Satan saying, look at your boy Job down there. You know, the only reason why he loves you is because you protect him. And God allowed him to go down there and bring all these things to Job. And finally, God asked, you know, Satan, where have you been? And he's, you know, he's down on earth. So maybe it's his spirit or what have you. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's also called the accuser, and he can't accuse us and point out all of our flaws if he's, you know, being burned alive right now.
That's a good point too. If he's either place, he can't do what he's accused of doing. I don't know. That's my problem too with there's a lot of contradictions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's hell. Hell is ingrained in literally like every culture in existence. Like everybody has some form of hell. Every religion, everyone has had it. Every civilization has some sort of bad afterlife.
Well, that's because there's a need for it.
Is it a human need?
I think so. Well, it's a moral need.
We're humans.
Well, it goes back, we've talked about before, the fear of death and why people have created the story of an afterlife.
It's comforting.
It's comforting to know there's an afterlife, but it gives a reason. If there's an afterlife of positive, you must give a negative afterlife so people don't go through life being assholes all the time. And that's the only reason I could think of it. End of the day, I have to tell you there's a reason.
I can't tell you there's a beautiful place and that you're going to go there, and then you can just say, screw it for the rest of your life.
You're going to go there unless you do this stuff. You know what I mean? You can't dangle the carrot.
Yeah, there's got to be some downside to it, or else it's not a good side.
Right.
Yeah, just let them go. But, I mean, I just had a few different hells I've listed down here that I just wanted to bring up and you know, just kind of run through them a little bit. Helheim is the final destination of Vikings that did not die a glorious death. So that was that important to them, that in their culture, that if you didn't die a glorious death, you went to a hell.
I know you don't know the answer to this, but what if you were a cook?
Oh, what a way to assume.
Well, what if you were a cook and you just died of old age, had a heart attack at 50 because you ate too many, you know, pies that you made? No. That's not a glorious death. Do you go to hell for that?
Yeah.
So just don't because
be a
you
cook. Be
just
a
because
soldier.
You weren't a warrior or
be a
soldier?
Soldier, yeah, warrior, whatever they, you know, the Viking warriors.
Wow,
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and keep Christianity for now.
All right, Christianity's still at the top.
I'm judging my religions today.
We're getting
based
rid of
on
the Viking one.
On how big of an asshole I can be versus not be and still get into heaven.
All right, Avishi is the hell of no interval. It's a Pure Land Buddhist, and it's the bottom part of their hell, which is called Naraka, like we talked about earlier. And you can die there, but you're born right back in Avishi.
Phil, whenever you were doing your studies, how much did you study Buddhism and Hinduism?
I know I had at least two semesters.
Do you know much about their negative afterlife? Or
so? Yeah, I dabbled a little bit into it. I've read some of the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas. I didn't read a whole lot of the Buddhist writings, but Zoroastrianism, the Tao. I've read quite a few of the books.
And what are some of the interesting things you could tell us about Naraka, or their version of hell? Not just their afterlife, but their negative version.
It's been a while, so I don't really want to speak too much on it. But I mean, most of it, you were absorbed back into Brahma and rebirthed. Or if you weren't a fine, upstanding citizen, you might be brought back as a lower life form.
So if you did bad, you might come back as a dog.
A worm,
even. I didn't even think about going that far.
Dogs have souls, Everett. Don't go there. Worms don't.
Well, let's talk about the there you go. That's a whole other swerve. But the old question of do pets get into heaven, that's not what I want
to
know.
All dogs go to heaven, Everett.
I don't want to know if pets can get to heaven. Let's assume they can. If they can get into heaven, that means pets must be able to go to hell, right?
Ooh. Oh. Wait a minute. Okay. Wait. Hold up. Can pets go to hell?
Or animals?
Can't, like, because I feel like
I would say no, because
if any animal has
pets,
a soul,
can't go to heaven.
Nah, hang on, come on, man. The gorilla, you've seen the gorilla sign on TV.
That doesn't mean it has a soul.
No, I know, but that's as close to us as you can freaking possibly get.
But it's not
is
us.
Them gorillas, man. Them gorillas got, if we got a soul, they got a soul. I'm going with that.
Well, if you're sticking to the letter of like how the Christian thing goes, I don't think pets get into heaven.
I'm not Christian, so I can, like, in my heart, I feel like gorillas have a soul. I mean, what do you think?
I think. I was just actually studying this today. If you go to the very first chapter of the Bible, Genesis 1, that same word that's translated creature is nephesh, and it means soul in Hebrew. If you go to chapter 2, when he's talking about Adam being created, and he said that he became a living soul, that same word is nephesh. So that same word for the creatures that he created and for man, they're both the same word. So absolutely. They have souls, and you've had enough pets to know they're all different.
That's right.
I don't know. I'd say just because they have personality doesn't mean anything. Because let's look at it this way: if pets in general can go to heaven, that means the next level down of beast, if you will, beast of burdens like donkeys or cows, have to go to heaven. And then if they go, then why can't all the way down to insects or bacteria? Where do you stop assigning souls? Does it have to have some sort of level of
consciousness, self-awareness? Maybe,
yeah.
I'm not sure.
I mean,
but even at a dog, they know not to stand in the fucking street when a car is coming. They can tell that. You know what I'm saying? They're not.
Well, so self-preservation is all it takes to have a soul. Is that what you're saying?
No.
So if you want to preserve yourself from dying, now you get into heaven.
No, it's got to be more than that. Emotion. Like my dog, I can tell when he's happy, sad, mad, sick, excited. I mean, I can look at him and tell that and judge. You can tell a dog has emotion. Like, there's emotion there. They can be sad.
So you're saying the assignment of a soul grants emotion? Is that what you're saying? I'm trying to draw your
conclusion.
No,
and I'm not saying correlation equals causation, but I'm saying that most of the time, like emotion would define, you know what I mean? That's something that it's so deep, like that would be in your soul.
It allows you to connect with it.
Fair. That's a good point. That's how I see it. That's not how other people might see it. But I feel like emotion's a big part of that determining. Well, like there's a test or something that fucking determines who has a soul. But no, I would say emotion's probably high on the scale. You're taking the test. Does this dude have a soul? Emotion? Yeah, that'd be a good thing on the test.
I don't know, honestly. I'm just saying, where does this giving out a soul stop? That's my question.
Are there squirrels in the trees in heaven? I mean,
I would say
do we
yes,
eat cheeseburgers
but that's only,
in heaven?
That's
do
only if heaven is created to be a representation of a life we're used to. He would fill it with animals if it's another version of Earth, so to speak, like a reincarnation. You're in a paradise, so
just
to speak.
Just a new Earth.
Yeah,
that's
that's what it is. Is a better Earth.
So it would make sense to me that it would be filled with animals of all sorts. But who's to say these animals that are filled with are the if this squirrel dies on the street here, does he go up and reincarnate immediately or be reborn into this new heaven as the physical version of that squirrel, so to speak? No, I don't think that's the way it works.
It's like Neo, you have that residual self-image, you know what I mean? It's
right, I mean, that's probably what you have in, if there's a place like heaven, you would see yourself, or everyone would see your representation, how you wanted to see, or as your essence exists, but I don't know. You get what I'm saying, though? I don't think it works like that for animals, at least in the logic.
The book of Isaiah talks about the wolf and the lion, or the lion and the sheep lying together, and a wolf and a sheep and a serpent being all led by a child. So and I think, you know, our version of heaven is a little bit warped. I mean, I think that goes all the way back to the Greeks, you know, where Zeus and, you know, I forget what the name of it was called, where all the gods went and
Mount Olympus.
Yeah, there you go. So I think that's where our version of heaven comes. Heaven's just a word that means wherever God is. So, you know, if God is here on earth, that's where heaven is.
I suppose that makes sense.
The book of Revelation, you know, talks about a new heaven and earth being established here as well. So, you know, Jerusalem is the apple of God's eye, and God created this earth. So I think at some point this will be right where it is all again. I mean, we probably won't have refineries anymore. It'll be a little bit nicer place. But, you know, again, heaven's where God is.
So it would make sense to say that wherever God is would be the perfect plane of existence, so to speak.
Absolutely.
So you can almost think about it like a mirror of Earth, where all the sludge and slime of this existence is pushed away, and you have a golden version where after you've lived your mortal existence, you get to go live the perfect existence. You can think of it that way.
So yeah, I think it's...
Let's flip it over then.
Like the Rick and Morty episode where there was the toxic universe where they went through that detoxifier and, you know. It was
similar
like
to that, but let's think about it like that. If heaven is the perfect version, then what is hell? It's got to be the flip side of if for you heaven is a sunny street where you get to hang out with everyone you've ever known, then wouldn't hell be the exact opposite, a cold, rainy day or a really super hot day? It'd just be torture all day long. If heaven is comfort, then hell is torture.
Or something that happens after judgment, you know, and at the final day, the book of Revelation 20, chapter 20 says there's a great white throne judgment, you know, and the dead, you know, the sea gives up the dead, you know, those that have all passed on. And if your name's not found in the book of life, then you're tossed into the lake of fire. Now, whether that lake of fire is forever and ever, I think you have to read that for yourself, but... You know, my interpretation is you're tossed in there and you're gone. I mean, it's so different than throwing a piece of trash in there. I mean, that doesn't burn forever.
That's fair enough.
So blinked out of existence, no longer conscious, no more soul. You're just done and gone after you can't be in heaven. That what hell is, you think? Or is it something that you notice? Like it's a noticeable thing. Like you're awake and aware for it or your soul or whatever it may be.
And if you keep reading, you get to chapter 21. He says there's a new heaven and a new earth, and there's no more death, there's no more pain, there's no more sorrow. That goes for God, too. I mean, how can he live with his children that loved him in paradise while knowing that he's tormenting his children over and over and over again? And I think that Everett had a good question, and he said, you know, how can an 80-year existence, even if you're, you know, basically a jerk-off all your life, I mean, how can that equate to eternal torture forever and ever? I mean, that's just, that's not a loving God, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't seem very fair, you know what I mean? Like, hell doesn't seem like this is very fair, because the way God's rules are laid out, from what I understand, you know, there's, you know, the Ten Commandments, you can't obviously break those, which I have another thing I want to go through, which 40 things you can do to get to hell, 40 actual sins. But it doesn't seem very fair for a man to say that has cheated on his wife to go to hell, the same hell that a guy that's raped and murdered people and children and just a very terrible human being. I mean, because both are hell-worthy trespasses. Both in the Bible say that those, you know, those are sins. Those will get you to hell. How can it be the same?
Well,
how can that sentence be the same for those two, you know, situations?
I don't know. I would have to say
it's not very fair, man.
Is everybody's hell the same? Would be the question.
No, more than that. Is it your own personal hell? You know what I mean? Is it not a communal hell where everybody just goes down to the one place?
But if you read the Bible, there's the sea made specifically, of damn souls and
specifically
whatnot.
For you, tailored to you. To what you hate,
I don't know,
because an 80-degree day to you might suck, but some people love sunny days. It would be, is it your own personal hell?
I get what you're saying. Is it a personal hell?
Yeah.
I don't think that's the way the Bible puts it.
No? Phil, what do you think?
I agree with Everett. I mean, the Bible doesn't put it like that. I mean, okay. You know, it's being blotted out, and Revelation at 20 also talks about the second death, the death of the soul. I mean, that's pretty clear, you know, that it's one and done. You go through this entire life, then we have a thing that we should probably talk about, the millennium, and then Satan's loose another small season to come back and tempt souls. And those that follow, I mean, they're cast into the lake of fire with him. He's also called the son of perdition, you know. I mean, he's got a death sentence, and at some point he will be gone amongst us as well, never to tempt or pollute, you know, for that matter, ever again. And those that follow and still after, you know, all of this time, not just the flesh age, but post flesh age, you know, if you still don't want anything to do with your father, I mean, it shows a lot of love to his children that love him to put them away from him. It's no different than a cat that has, you know, six kittens and two are sick. I mean, she takes those two and puts them away because she loves her other kittens.
Right. Sure. Sia Marie Davy says in the chat, this is what, just going back to speak what we were talking about earlier with purgatory. If there is a heaven, I would like it if animals went to heaven too. I would like to see my dog again.
Okay, so to retort to that, we were watching a video earlier where a guy was talking about that. If you need your animal to get into to be in heaven with you, then you're not ready for heaven.
And that's what purgatory is for, the final purification process. If you can't be happy in heaven without your dog or your family or all of your lifely things, that's what purgatory is for, to help you to get ready.
At least that was his opinion anyway.
It was a preacher. We were watching some Christian videos earlier. And I thought that was pretty interesting, like that. And the way this guy described it is that it was God's gift to souls to have this place in order to be ready to get, you know, because he doesn't want you to be there if you're not ready. That's what, you know, this life's for. You know what I mean? So like, if you still can't, you know, be happy in heaven without this and without that, then you know you have purgatory, which is like the final purification. So they consider it a gift from him. What do you think?
I think animals are definitely a gift, but I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to see your dog there. I mean, hell, I want to see.
I don't think there is either. I would love to see everybody there, but
no, I'm not speaking to that either, one way or the other. I'm just saying that this guy had described it as purgatory being the place that if you can't be happy in heaven without your dog, like I want my dog there too. I mean, I understand. I love my dog as well. But that's not what God's about. If you can't be happy in heaven without your dog, you need a few more years in purgatory. And that's where I said to you, it's like a brainwashing place. Is that what this is? Is purgatory like, you know, where they brainwash you?
Again, based on what this priest believes and the way he believes, that's the way God operates.
Yeah, of course. This one guy. I just liked how it was, and I thought it was interesting. So I figured I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah.
And I think there's a difference between hoping that your dog's there, or I don't want to go unless my dog's there.
Well, that's fair. Yeah, well, that's totally fair.
I know we were supposed to be talking about hell. We're spending a lot of time talking about heaven, and
right.
But it's all about judgment, really.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, and it's the same thing. This might piss people off, but I'm going to liken children and people of many mental handicaps to animals. If they have never had anything more than base emotion, like a baby has nothing more than base emotion, very similar to an animal, and it can get into heaven. Then I guess at that point, why can't a dog who has a very similar, in my experience, earthly existence of just raw emotion and love?
Yeah, that's all they know. Feed.
But what if it's a shithead dog that is trained to fight and kill and enjoys it?
Well, that's the same as a kid that wasn't raised. If you know, religion and heaven and hell are a real thing, and the kid's parents doesn't raise him to know this stuff.
So you can
stuff,
be twisted into the point.
Is he an innocent even though he's not aware of what he should be doing? I mean, obviously
there's
the moral right and wrong are always going to be there. You know what I mean? I feel like...
So you're saying that soul as a human never had the opportunity to exist as a righteous
being? To be saved, yeah, never had that opportunity. No one took him to church. No one told him, hey, even here's 10 rules that you should guide by. Just if that was never part of the equation... Are you still an innocent at that point? Do you still get a chance?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Phil, what do you think about that? It
brings us to the, you know, something that happened. So I'm not trying to digress too much, but if you read Revelation, it talks about trumps and vials and You know, that these things are happening, you know, and, you know, that's where you get the 666, right? You know, Satan's kicked out of heaven at the sixth trump, the sixth vial, and the sixth seal. I mean, it's it's plain to see when you read it, actually. And then there's, you know, seven trumps, seven vials, and seven seals in total. And once those three happen, that's when Christ returns. And at that point, a thing called the millennium starts. If you ever heard of the Lord's Day or the millennium, and where do we get that word from? Second Peter chapter 3 tells us a day with the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day with the Lord. So again, they call it the Lord's Day. We know it to be 1,000 years. We get this millennium.
Can you explain that one more time to me, Phil? I need to put that together again. Go ahead.
Starting with
what? About it being 1,000 years per day, like just that the quote that you said.
The Lord's Day is 1,000 years.
So that's how they judge time in the Bible, is one Lord's day.
A day with the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day with the Lord.
Okay. So that would be fair to say that it took 7,000 years to create Earth?
Absolutely. Not to create Earth, but
everything.
Because we know that the Earth is, you know, billions of years old.
Yes, yes, yes. Definitely. And that's a lot of the, you know, there's contradictions in the religion, the Bible, and, you know, science that always obviously comes up. So, yeah, I never knew that's why that 1,000 days with the Lord is like one day. One day is like that.
Well, it's not like dog years, man.
Well, no, but I just never understood how that they only thought that it was 6,000 or 10,000 years old. Like, you know, I don't think
that's what he's saying, though.
No, but that's obviously the equation that they're using.
Oh, absolutely. And you'll get Christians today that make, you know, other Christians look silly when they say, well, you know, the Earth's only 7,000 years old. And they're like, you're making us all look bad, because it's not. I mean, if you read Genesis, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, period. And then it said, and the earth became void. Well, Hebrew doesn't have a word that says became, just like Spanish doesn't have. You know, became. Spanish uses the word estar, to be, and you would say it used to be. It you know, they don't have words like became or was.
Sure, it's all about tense, like when and, you know, like the context of it rather than, yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, an age of spiritual bodies before this age, you know. Again, second, Peter chapter 3 talks about the age that was, the age that is, and the age that's going to come. So, you know, I think when people talk about Atlantis and Age of Aquarius and all of these life, you know, that happened beforehand, that there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, this flesh age isn't old, but life's been on Earth since the beginning.
Nice. Yeah, it's very... it's intriguing, man. Like I said, even though I don't believe in any of this stuff, it's all very interesting to talk about, to learn about, and to just theorize, you know, just
me and you, discuss. We both went to like a Christian church when we were kids anyway, so, and we were raised in America, which pretty much imprints the Christian belief on you, believe it or not.
Fair, right.
If you grow up in America, you have a base belief, whether you listen to it or not, that's more or less Christian.
Right. The laws, everything, a lot of the stuff is centered around.
It's like you believe in Santa Claus. It's the American culture, so to speak. Unless you, you know, you import it in as a part of a family who comes from another country who has another culture, that's what you pretty much believe in.
Yeah, you're not saying 100% of the time. You're saying generally, for the most part, it's ingrained in our culture here in America, Christianity.
Yep, that's basically what I'm saying, yeah. So everyone has that same basis fear. Well, not everyone, but you get my point. As a child, yeah. That's whenever you form your beliefs, and I think that's huge in America. I think that's basically how all of us, even if your parents aren't religious. I have a 4-year-old daughter now who has so many questions that are coming out of nowhere about God and hell and things like that. It's just because that's our culture. I mean, you're going to see it on TV. You can't help it,
right?
And you try to ask her. I mean, and 20 years down the road, are you going to look, you know, could you look back and say, yeah, I was wrong on that, and I probably should have said something different. But,
oh, that's probably how it'll happen.
Yeah, no shit.
but you love her, and you're trying to give her the answers that she's looking for. So does it make you bad? No. Could you be wrong or flawed, you know, with your answer? Maybe.
Probably.
Yeah, no shit. It's so hard. I mean,
especially since an answer she's asking, there's no person on earth who can, with absolute certainty, tell you what's happening when you die. So,
no.
I think my job as a father is to tell her the answer that she can handle, the answer that doesn't keep her up at night. Now, if I was a religious man, I don't think I would care if that answer kept her up at night. You know what I mean?
Right. I have absolutely no problem with my kid. That's what you're saying, like that she can handle. It's easier for my kid to believe, you know, in that. And that's fine with me. I have no issue just because that's not part of me. I am not going to deprive you of that. If you can get the sort of feeling, if that can complete you and you can get out of it what other people do, I'm not going to deprive you of that. I would never do that. You know what I mean? So, like, when she asks me these questions, I'm not going to directly set her up for
failure. What would
you
say? Let me ask you this. I get what you're saying. What would you say to the asshole that says, you're allowing your kid to be deluded?
Well, you know what?
I would say you're an asshole.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. I told him to go fuck himself. Yeah.
No, but a lot of people come at it like that. I just don't get that. Yeah. That, you know, like, you have to be so specifically right about it, you know, that you don't believe, but in you can look at a kid and be so hardcore in your belief that you're going to fuck with them like that?
Right. Well, my daughter's first dose with death was a dog that we had, and she asked, she didn't understand. And I didn't tell her, you know, he's buried out in the backyard. She asked me where he went. And I said he went to heaven. And in her mind, she was probably three at the time, she immediately related that to a person, and it was heaven's house. So from then, and it was just easier for her to say, hey.
That's because of her conception of it?
Of her conception of it. Yeah. And again, later on down the road, I realized it probably wasn't the best idea, obviously. But heaven's house, that was like, he's in heaven. Heaven's house.
I get the same type of stuff.
But then came the questions, where is heaven's house? Can we go to visit Drake at heaven's house? She didn't really get the fact that, like, he's no longer here. That's not a thing. You know what I mean? It took her a few more years to realize that heaven was a place that was beyond earth. You know what I mean? She just didn't have to. I'm just basically saying to the fact that what you say, what she can handle. And I gave her what she needed to complete that, you know, grieving process, I guess.
I think we're going to have to rename this episode.
Yeah, no shit. It didn't turn into hell. It turned out Surreal Talk goes into religion.
Well, I would say it turned into Surreal Talk goes into the moral afterlife. And
fair.
I don't know. I think it's been a fun discussion so far anyway.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Anything else that you wanted to touch on, Phil?
I know you had a lot of stuff here.
Yeah, you had
some
stuff on there, the three world ages, and then there was another thing too. I didn't know what it was either. Blotting out, what is that? You had put that on some of the notes that you wanted to talk about.
Well, and I think that's really, you know, from what I've read, I mean, blotted out is, I mean, gosh, I think it's in there 30 plus times. And he talks about, God. I'm also saying that there's one author of this book. So, you know, whether Jeremiah wrote it or Paul wrote it, we're talking about God when I say that.
Okay.
Instead of tormenting, I mean, he throws you in the lake of fire when it's, I mean, obviously you've had plenty of chances and gone through, the flesh age, the millennium, and you're blotted out. I mean, they blotted out of the book as you never existed. I mean, it's gone. You're erased from memory. So I think that's very important to know that he's not going to, again, sit there and know that for eternity you're being tormented. It's a one and done.
So it's just it's a game over. You're just blinked basically out of existence. You don't exist anymore, and don't know that you don't exist because
I'd say that's easier on you than going to hell, though.
That fair, then that might be his mercy right there in the theory, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly the way I look at it. I mean, do you want that? I mean, you probably have plenty of people that'll say, well, heck, that's easy. I'll just die and be done. I mean, it's your choice, I guess, if that's what you want to do. But, when it says eternal life or eternal, torment or sorrow, It's
the question is existence in any form, be it in a damned torture, is that better than no existence? That's the question. It's like being alive. Like, would you rather be alive and have cancer and have all the horrible pain that goes with it or just be dead?
Oh,
right. It's the same thing, in the afterlife. Would you rather be linked out of existence or spend eternity in hell or torture or whatever hell is?
or heaven.
I would think I would rather easily blink out of existence if that's my case, but that seems like people would get off too light. But if you have a merciful God, I guess that's what he does. But I've always heard we also have a vengeful God.
Yeah, well, so think New Testament on this one.
Not Old Testament?
No,
there
Old Testament was, you know, the motherfucker.
That's a good point.
Am I right? He was a lot more vengeful in the Old Testament, eh?
I think he could still be brought to wrath at any point of time. You know, maybe the wordings are different, but, you know, if you turn your back to him, he'll turn his back to you, you know, and that's at some point, how long can you be tested or how long can you test him, really? At some point, how much can you hate him and not want him, or enough's enough?
Right. Well, I've always maintained the fact that 100% I would require evidence to believe in a God. But at the same time, like if that evidence was presented to me, if he came down or wherever from heaven and came to me directly in front of my face and said, Eric Hicks, you've been messing up. What are you doing? You need to, I'm here. I'm real. Why are you, what are you doing? What are you doing not believing in me? I would be the first one to drop to my knees and completely submit myself to that. But I totally would. Yes. But I would have to have that evidence because it's such a, to me, a fringe idea of the entire master of the universe. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, but I would need the evidence. But again, if the evidence was there, I'd be the very first one on the ground. I'm sorry for what I've done. Show me the way. You know what I mean? So I can't say that I wouldn't. I really would.
It's an interesting philosophy in how you want your God to behave.
What do you mean?
And how you behave with your God. I don't know. I'm just saying. I find it interesting.
It's my God. You got your own God.
That's what I'm saying.
You behave with your God the way you want.
Well, that's a good point. Everyone creates their own version of God, so to speak, their own version of the way they see it. So I don't know. I like your version. It's interesting. That's all I was saying.
Yeah. He comes out, hey, bro, what the fuck? What are you doing? I'm like, oh, my bad. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Is that what you're saying? That's the way it works with God for you?
I feel like God would call me bro, maybe, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he would be like, bro.
Anyway, going down your list here, Phil. Go ahead. You had something there.
The Israelites were no different, right? You know, they were brought out of Egypt. He parts the Red Sea for them. Mm-hmm. And you know, they go into the wilderness. Moses goes up the mountain to go get the Ten Commandments, and he comes down, and they've already thrown their gold together, made a golden image, and they're worshiping. I mean, they're begging Aaron to go and make them make us a god out of gold so we can worship it. I mean, he literally just brought you out of slavery and parted for.
And they were like, "What you done for me lately?"
Exactly. So I mean, humanity's always wanted that tangible God that we can touch. I mean, that's why he gave kings. You know, starting with Judah. You know, all the way through, you know, Queen Elizabeth. We've always had these people because we needed that. Our faith in him wasn't enough.
To go along with that, we listened to a good story, I think, from that same internet preacher, so to speak, was talking about the warriors who had died in battle, who were devout. They were Jewish, actually, he said, in his story. They were right with God their whole life, and the only thing they ever did wrong was they went into battle and basically had a small amulet, which is a good luck charm.
Yeah,
but the representation of that to God would be, well, you're not really.
You need more than what I can provide,
right? You don't have complete faith in me that you have to have this external idol. I don't know. I always found that kind of interesting. Well, since I heard it today,
yeah, for the last 2 hours, yeah, no, that is cool. That's weird. That's just so many different interpretations of it, you know, of heaven or hell and everything. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and how God behaves, and it's. It seems like they all went to like a writer's meeting for religions, and they all was like, okay, so here's the main ideas. This is what, you know, the deal is. And they all just went off their separate ways and ran with it and made their own little shit. You got, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Catholics, the whole nine, all of them. I don't know. There's just so much similarities there. You know what I mean?
I got you, yeah.
Well, and why did they do it? You know, why did these religious people, so to speak, these religious organizations have like a crazy place where you're going to be like tormented day in and day out and all these bad things are going to happen? They're trying to drive you into their building. And
exactly. I was going to say that it's for that tithing.
Ooh.
Exactly.
That's a great point.
They're just like, you know, back, you know, a few hundred years ago when you could buy pittance, you know, to the Catholic Church. You could buy your way out of hell, and you could give money to the Catholic Church.
It's kind of like when you go into confession and they say you could you do a 10 Hail Marys, and or you can just give me $10.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much. Buy your way out
of hell. You can buy a blessing. Blessings, you know, for cheap. Buy one, get one.
And I'm a firm believer that Constantine never became Christian. He Romanized true Christianity. And you see the Roman symbolisms and influence throughout Christianity today.
Well, fair enough, but does that have something to do with the basis of modern Christianity being based out of Italy, and just that's the fact of the culture there?
Well, I mean, you have so many traditions that have been brought in from other religions, and, you know, thousands of years ago, they're different traditions, that it's so murky. You know, I mean, that's why, going back to the first question you asked me, do I go to a church? No. You know, I mean, how many churches bring the Easter Bunny in every you know, year?
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, I know the three of us know that Ishtar is a Babylonian fertility ritual that they brought, you know, and they bring in so much nonsense. And,
definitely.
The version of hell is no different.
Agreed. It's whatever, and I can't say it's whatever, because to assign money as the main motivation for religion is a bad thing, because not every religious man is in it for money. You know what I mean?
Power, like, man.
No, control. It's not even that. You're saying, I can't say all day long that every person who started a religion or practices a religion or teaches or spreads a religion is only in it for the money. Like the preacher down on the corner, He's probably not in it just to make his money.
Probably genuinely wants to help people feel and experience what he's experiencing and help. You know, they call preachers and pastors the fisher of men. Is that right? Am I right in saying that quote? They're the fishers of men, and that's what they do. They're fishermen. They fish for your soul to help you. You know, most of them. Excuse me.
What was that, Phil? Oh,
sorry.
Oh no, I was just saying. Is that right though? Is that what I mean? I'm right there as far as the.
You can liken them to politicians. I mean, think about that 25-year-old that goes into politics. Is he the same man that he was when he's 45 and been in politics for a while?
If you're Bernie Sanders. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
But, I mean, if you go in bright-eyed and you know, wanting to make a big change, but you get worn down. And, you know, think about the people that lead churches. You know, where do they come from? Where do they learn? Where do they get their credential? And I think that has a lot to do with it. If you go to seminary and you go become a Catholic priest, if all of a sudden you start changing your views and start changing your words, they're going to remove you. So, yeah, your pension through your church, I mean, that has a lot to do with it. I mean, your paycheck, your livelihood as being a pastor, that has a lot to do with it.
That's a good point, too. You got to keep your story consistent. No matter how your view changes throughout life, hopefully you don't change your complete view of Christianity, or else you're out as the pastor that they come to Sunday
Bad
after
for
Sunday.
Business, man.
So to speak, to hear that specific message and not your interpretation of it, so to speak. Well, maybe in a way your interpretation, but not a radically different.
We always hear of these preachers that have been a preacher. They're 50 years old. They've preached for 20 years, and then now all of a sudden they have this midlife crisis, and they're done with it. And you know,
hear about that a lot? I never hear about that.
Oh, I've read stories about that. A preacher just up and quits. He's done with it. He doesn't, you know. Whatever, maybe his wife died or something, and he loses faith. You know, loss of faith is an issue as well, because you got to have a lot of faith to be able to. And I hate the word buy into it, but to buy into this, faith is a big thing.
Fair enough.
Especially from the religious aspect. I'm not saying like the higher power thing, but to believe what the religions are vomiting, trying to cram down your throat.
I like the way you put it.
To buy into that sort of thing, you've got to have some big faith, man.
You were saying too how they're credentialed and how they have to go through seminary school and everything like that. Does every preacher go to seminary school? Is that a requirement in Christianity that you go to seminary to become?
Nope. Good question.
If you're a priest, yeah, but so you guys went to a church when you were a kid. What was it like, East Dalton Assembly of God?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, one of those down there. I don't remember exactly which one we went to.
Right,
we were really young.
The Assemblies of God is a large organization, and, you know, they own their own Bible colleges. I mean, there's one right in Missouri. So, you know, your mom and dad take you to that Assembly of God when you're a kid, and you say, hey, I want to be a preacher. I want to do great things. Well, where are you going to go? I'm going to go to the Bible college that's owned by the Assembly of God. When I graduate, they put me in one of their denominations. You know, so you learn it as a little kid from the preacher and Sunday school teacher and your mom and your dad, and then you go to a college that's owned by that organization, and they put you in front of a church that's owned by their organization. So, you know, the thing you learn at Bible college isn't the same you're going to learn at seminary. I mean, seminary school is strictly for, you know, Catholics.
Okay, so seminary is just, that's the Catholic college for priests, and everything else is like a, you know, like a, but here, so what's it cost? I mean, is that expensive, I wonder?
I would think they would sponsor you.
Yeah, there you go. That's the question. Do you get it for free?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, either it's free or they, you know, they reimburse you. I don't know. I've never got that far. I mean, like, and that's why I never went to a specific, you know, college that was owned by an organization. I wanted to go and learn it on myself.
Right.
So
yeah, that'd probably be better than seeing their painted view of what it is. You get to go see the more educational view.
Right. Well, and like, so like the seminary is not going to teach you about what like Pentecostals will call the rapture. And, you know, Evangel Bible College isn't going to teach you about purgatory. I mean, you're going to learn what my sect believes in.
Right. So it's much in the sense you go to college and learn different courses. You know, you're either taking the Christian course or you know, whatever. You know, if you're going to be a rabbi, you're taking the Jewish course.
Pretty much. Hey, you had a question here, Phil, that I wanted to jump into here. You asked, this is something you wanted to talk about. Why do we give a preacher respect, and why do we believe that he knows the answers? Like, I get the basis of your question here, but could you expound on what the point you're trying to make there is? Or I assume you had a thought behind that.
Well, it is. I think we need to test those things. But at the same time, do we ask our doctor, hey, what did you, you know, what were your grades? Or, you know, any of people that are, I guess, in positions of authority.
Sure.
I took a psychology class at Iowa State, and, you know, they said the uniform alone makes us feel good. This guy's important. I mean, if he's got a white coat and a little thing on his head, I mean, he's a doctor, and we believe him.
Fair enough. It's the confidence.
There's truth to that, though, because when I went and moved to the current job that I'm at now, in an office job, and I actually got to come into work in, you know, like a little more than just my, you know, blue Aramark uniform that I get from work. That was like awesome, cool. And it's not like I felt more important, but it was a nice thing to be able to.
I don't get what you're getting at.
Well, we don't have to dress super nice here.
But how does that relate?
What do you mean?
I don't know how that relates to why we.
Because he was just saying like it's important. You feel important with the coat on. You feel it's
that's not what he's saying at all.
Oh well, then why don't you explain to me what Phil's saying, Everett? I'm just kidding. That was a joke.
No, basically saying that, you know, like, you know, the uniform, you know, you kind of respect that person. And when you show up to a church and you got a guy in a suit and tie on standing in front of everybody, you know, talking about God, you just automatically start to listen to this person. You're like, man, he sounds good.
I say it's more than a uniform. He's up in front and he seems to know what he's talking about. I think it helps. Whenever a person stands and speaks with authority on a subject that you're seeking answers to, I think that's whenever you will give them respect.
Pretty much. Absolutely. Really. Go ahead.
No, and I mean, that's just a question that I ask. I'm like, why do we let that person tell us how to live our life? And
psychologically wise, because we believe this one person of anybody else on earth is my close representation to ensure my ticket to a happy afterlife. People who, sure, they don't know the answer to what happens when they die. People have a fear of death. Anybody who says they don't, they're probably a psychopath. You know what I mean?
So, right.
And a lot of people who dwell on that thought, maybe not consciously, but have a problem with what happens whenever you die after your end of existence, or afraid not to exist anymore. You want to try to kind of lock that in. And I think that's why a lot of people will give credence to what these people say, even though, and I'm not saying generalizing that every Catholic preacher out there is a pederast, but there's a lot of them out there that seemingly like children. But we don't think about that. We look for this man up here who knows the answers. I think that's why we give them any kind of credence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and how do you go to a church? I mean, because mom takes you or because your friend invites you. I mean, there's not a whole lot of research into what kind of church you're going to go to. Unless you're in it for a while and you start to make your own decisions and you say, you know, I want to learn this way. I mean, so there's not a whole lot of study or research True. Before you go to a church. You just show up or someone takes you.
Well, that's two different points there. There's the basis of indoctrination from a child, and then there's the people who are, say, born again as adults who choose that life. You get what I mean? The difference there, Eric, what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, totally. You're taken to church. You're told to believe this. This is what you have to do as a kid. But if you choose to do it later on in life, I feel like it would mean a little more.
It could go
like
either.
A born-again Christian.
I don't know that you could say it means either more to either person, honestly, at that point.
Fair.
I don't know. It's a weird thing. Boy, I don't know that we've gotten anywhere today on our discussion with this, but boy, has it sure been a fun discussion.
Yeah, it totally has.
Wait, let's listen to what God said about burning his children alive.
Let's hear it.
Okay. We know who Molech is, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. The devil, yeah. Or the demon, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, and you know, what Molechism is. What's the place out there where people get gay in San Francisco?
Oh, Route 42 rest area? Wait.
Like, what?
No, the big Grove, Bohemian Grove.
Oh, Bohemian Grove.
Oh,
yeah.
We love us some Bohemian right. Grove here on Got Surreal Talk.
Big statue of Molech, who's represented as an owl.
Uh-huh.
At night. You know, and what do? They, you know, burn a big stick figure in effigy. You know, it's symbolic of burning somebody alive to please the god Molech. And, you know, Jeremiah talks about it.
It's mock sacrifice.
Mock sacrifice. But, you know, back, you know, thousands of years ago, when, you know, in Babylonian times, they did this. They actually, you know, would pass their child through the fire of Molech, you know, and burn them alive to please him. And, you know, in Jeremiah 32, verse 36, you know, God said that I didn't even... You know, you're doing this. That thought has never even crossed my mind to do that. You know, so again, we talk about being in hell and God burning his children forever and ever. I mean, he tells us in Jeremiah that thought has never even crossed my mind to do.
Yeah, that goes another good point. That the idea we have now is pretty much thanks to Dante and his book, The Inferno.
Really? Yep. Oh,
I think so. Our modern thought of it. It's just like why we think of Santa Claus, you know, the modern Santa Claus, is because Coca-Cola put out a nice advertising campaign. Dante right. put out a nice advertising campaign for his idea of hell and what he thought was going to happen to the people who had different political beliefs and other things like that when he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing, too, about it, the Inferno I didn't like, is how he would assign hells to these people who are just differently politically biased than he was. Look into that sometimes. It's quite interesting.
Yeah?
Yep.
Like that movie, Big Trouble in Little China, how they had all the different variations of hell.
Nothing like that at all.
No, I not say like that, but I like that.
Oh.
You know, yeah. That was just...
The Chinese, how, yeah. well, like how Hindus and and Buddhists have their version of hell that has like 26 different levels or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
and each of those have each of their different levels, like the one that's split up into eight versions of hot hell and eight versions of cold hell.
That's right, yeah. There's a lot of hell out there. There's so many different.
Anyway.
All right, well, I'm about done with it. What do you think?
Yeah. Phil, thanks for coming on, man. I'm sorry we didn't stick so much to hell talk. We just got kind of into a basis of religion.
Yeah,
I don't know how it turned that way. Just things happen that way with us.
Yeah, hey, I appreciate you having me on, you know. And, you know, for anybody that still wants to know more about it, I would always say don't trust, you know, this man or any other man, you know. Study to show yourself approved and get in there and learn for yourself.
That's the motto of the show, pretty much.
I have one more question. That's a great question, Phil. Did you, when you were thinking about what you wanted to do for college, did you go into this field as a way to help yourself figure out what you thought, like as far as what pertains to God, Jesus, the afterlife?
Was it a personal quest for answers?
Was it a personal quest for answers? But at the same time, you know, could you get some knowledge to help you in a career later on?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually thought that. You know, I would be in a structured place where we would, you know, study the scriptures and study the history and kind of figure out where all these things came from. And, you know, I found that there were many times that I would ask teacher questions or write papers on subjects, and you know, these have been there for years, and they're like, "Yeah, I've really never touched on that subject before." So I thought it was going to be something that it didn't really end up quite being. I think it was more a history lesson of.
Did you get the feeling that it was more or less just an industry alive now only to support itself? That's what it kind of sounds like to me. It's like, yeah, we never really thought of that before, but keep paying your tuition.
Well, I mean, like I said, it was more of a history lesson. It wasn't like deemed towards, you have to believe this one way.
I mean, they
were just information.
Like what he said, history lesson, right. You know.
Yeah, and you had a lot of times where it was like, you know, you go and read this and tell me what you think. There was never a force of like, no, that actually you think that, so it's wrong. I never had that, you know, and I wanted to stay away from denomination-based colleges. Like I said, I went to a large private or large public university. I mean, they didn't care what you believe. They just wanted to have you
to impart knowledge as it was
written.
Tell
them that I've read this and this is what I came up with.
That's fair enough, yeah. I mean, what else would you want more in when you're trying to learn than examine the evidence and things that exist in that area and try to bring an understanding to it? That's education in general, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's not the same anymore. I mean, you know, you're kind of pushed one way or the other in colleges, I believe, now.
Yeah, there's education. That's a whole other subject we could talk about, from the Institution of Common Core Math in elementary school all the way up to college for profit these days. I don't know. But yeah, we could spend a lot of time on that. Yeah. But anyway, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, we totally appreciate it, man. Definitely. Thanks for coming on.
Hopefully it didn't leave any kind of horrible taste in your mouth, and one day we can get back on and have you have a little bit more of a structured discussion that we probably would expect ourselves to go along that line a little bit more.
Like, he was worried at the beginning he was going to go off on some tangents.
Yeah.
We're like, well, you just don't know.
So anyway, we really appreciate you coming on, man.
Yeah, thank you.
I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, for everybody, for Everett and Eric, visit us on YouTube, which is, what's the address, Everett?
YouTube.com/SurrealTalkPodcast.
On Twitter at?
Twitter.com/SurrealTalkShow.
And on Facebook at?
Facebook.com/SurrealTalkPodcast. You can also find our Facebook group as Facebook.com/group/SurrealTalkGroup. And that's basically just a whole bunch of people who listen to the podcast getting together, trading the article links and stories and memes and all kinds of fun stuff. Eric and I are on there every day. You've heard us talk about it. If you haven't joined yet, why not?
Yep. Sub us on YouTube. Like us. Appreciate it, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks again, everybody. And that's the end of the show. We're still live. Thanks again, Phil, for coming on, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We're still live on YouTube, but the podcast is over. So.
I appreciate it. It was fun. Like I said, I mean, it's not a clear-cut answer. You just say, what is it? And you tell them.
For sure.
Yeah, we were talking about earlier today. We're like, man, this episode's basically, and it happened not how we thought. It's going to devolve down into the philosophy discussion rather than talking about, you know, specifics of hell, which you can't really get into specifics of any hell because we know no real specifics.
Yeah. All we know is what every other person has told us.
Yeah, we'll probably get together, me and you, this week, actually. I want to record another part to the show to where we do discuss all the other, like, because we had a bunch of information about all the different types of hells
and stuff like that. Yeah.
It didn't feel like it really fit with
Not with how the discussion was going. It didn't fit in there. I tried to shove a couple in there, and it just didn't.
Forced.
Yeah, we were on a roll with you know, just the way it was going, and I liked it. I like those sorts of shows, like this type of discussion, where it's not so much about facts, but it's more about just like what you feel like. You know, your opinion is on the certain situation and how you think about stuff. You know what I mean?
Totally, totally.
Theoretical. You know what I mean? Just open for discussion.
Agreed.
I don't like the ones where we have to sit there and just regurgitate facts. I like the ones where, you know, we get to ponder a bit.
It's like a faxism. How often do we regurgitate
facts?
Facts
is my strong suit. We're basically fake news, aren't we?
Kind of. All right. Well, you ready to get off here?
Yeah, I am. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. Hey, we got a Patreon. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah. Let's not worry about the Patreon today. All right. Thanks again, Phil, man. We'll catch you later.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
See you, man.
Please. Wake up.
This has been Surreal Talk, a lineupmedia.fm production. Listen online at surrealtalkpodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets.
How come I know so much? What the hell is going on around here? Who are you people?
Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.
I'm mad as hell! I'm not going to take it anymore!
This podcast was a presentation of LightUpMedia.fm.